do some real business afterwards. That is the idea. Yeah. So we'll see what happens. So let's just move on.
So where we ended was to was not to get attached to the path. So let go of the path and.
Yeah. The next one is when you reach the end of the path, you let it go. Yeah. This is one of those other very famous misconceptions about the path, and this is a. I think a very important one, because here the idea is that when you come to the end of the path, you're so wise, you can do whatever you want. It's very handy, right? This was what we talked about before, about we come to the end of the path and you can just, you know, really abuse, drink alcohol and have relationships, and it doesn't matter because you are enlightened. Enlightened people, no need to hold on to anything, you can do whatever you want. You know that famous saying by one of those famous scallywags.
Sorry. We are coming to this.
Just giving introduction to this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. So one of those famous scallywags in Buddhism is the famous. He wasn't a Buddhist, but he was from another thing, and he used to say that I'm so detached and I'm not even attached to detachment. Right? And this fellow, he had 26 Rolls Royces and all these kind of things, but he wasn't attached to the Rolls Royces, so it was okay. He could have whatever he wanted, basically. It's quite handy, right? It sounds like a good excuse, because you have got to the end of the path, you can let it go, so you can really chill. And of course, the point about this, it really comes again in the same Alagad Upama Sutta Ananda. See, now I remember, thanks to you. So it comes in the same sutta again, the idea that, we have it here. This raft has been very helpful to me. Why don't I beach it on dry land or set it adrift on the water and go wherever I want? That's what that person should do with a raft. And this is where it comes to this idea. It comes from here, probably early on, that the idea you can set the whole path to one side and now you can just do exactly what you like and you can have all kind of do all kind of crazy things. But remember, the reason why you can set the raft aside is not, it doesn't mean that then you can do whatever you want. The whole reason is because you have internalized the path. Yeah, you are carrying these values with you. You are kind by nature. You have right view by nature. You are practicing the Eightfold Path by nature at all times. You don't need to grasp onto this path anymore. It happens automatically. So if someone claims that this means you can act in whatever way you want, they have absolutely misunderstood what this is about. It says in the suttas, when you are a stream enterer, then you are perfect in conduct, perfect in right action. Yeah. So it means the opposite of that you can do whatever you want. In fact, that is one of the ways of knowing that someone is not enlightened. Yeah, if they do all kind of crazy things. If someone has 26 Rolls Royces, chances they are enlightened are very slim. Maybe they are zero, I don't know, but very close to zero anyway. And if someone does all kind of things, they abuse you in various ways, or they indulge in the sensual pleasures or whatever, of course, they guarantee they're not going to be enlightened. So, first of all, we said you should attach to the path. Yeah, this is kind of the thing here. Yeah, so you should attach to the path until you are a stream enterer. When you are a stream enterer, you let go. But you let go only because it is internalized and is part of who you are. Huh?
I was sort of worried again. You're gonna preemptively talk about my slides again. Never mind. I forgive you. All right. So here we go. So letting go of the path when you're at the end. So there's this thing called divine madness, and there's people who have. Finish the path, maybe, and some of these people are, let's say, they're behaving in a way which is not, it's not sort of the social norms, and sometimes they are seen as they have reached to the end of the path. So what I wanted to say about this was, why I wanted to take this part was that, you know, letting go, and this is part of the divine madness, is part of that. So what happens, what's divine madness? Here we go. One of the most famous Buddhist teachers, actually, in the West. You might not know this monk. Well, he wasn't a monk at the end, but he was a monk when he was a bit younger. If you don't know him, his name was Trungpa Rinpoche. And I was actually part of this group for a while. He was a famous teacher. Mm.
Did you inherit some of the divine madness from him?
Maybe. And it's interesting. He was very interesting teacher and very controversial. The idea of not just him, but with these people who have like sort of have this divine madness, that the idea is that you're teaching others that the life is an illusion. You don't need to follow sort of certain way of a behavior, social norms, and this and that. And it's an illusion anyway. So, what is there? Why would you act in certain ways? It's your teaching. One of the things, what they say about Trungpa Rinpoche himself, that he was trying to stop followers from getting attached to him. In Tibetan Buddhism, there's a very strong idea of guru, and the guru comes sometimes. Quite often, it's thought that the teacher, the guru, comes before the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha. Whatever the guru teaches, you go with them, and the teacher is very important. And it's certainly true, I think, in quite often in any traditions, whether it's Buddhist, different traditions of Buddhism or any other way, there's people do get attached to your teacher. People who have this kind of divine madness, they are living example that there is no self. So again,
are they the living example? Are they pretending to be it, or is it? You know, is it?
Yeah. Whether they are really that, that's true. But I mean, sometimes there is, like I said, historically, there's always been people like this, and they sort of maybe they are. There's these things being projected on them. Mm. Quite often, they don't claim anything themselves. There's quite interesting stories in Japan and in Zen stories where there's these monks, just wanderers, were sort of seem to be a bit crazy, but they just have these one sayings, and they just represent this thing idea that there is no self there. Anyways, I don't know what to say about that. But does it really work? Is it really that way? Do these people living, are they examples? Are they stopping people, followers getting attached to him? Do they teach others that life is illusion? Does it really work? I'm not sure. For example, with this teacher, Trungpa Rinpoche, who's in this picture, people really, really attached to him. Even though didn't want people to get attached to him, but it was quite the opposite. He was such a charismatic teacher that people are still regarded him as their teacher.
Was he enlightened, do you think?
That I don't know.
You don't know.
From the behavior, it's going to come later, what the Buddha said about these things and the way how you should behave. I guess I don't believe that anymore, and I don't think I never believed that. But in Tibetan Buddhism, or you know, certain there is that idea that you can, you know, once you let go of the raft, you are still you are enlightened, but you are just not behaving in a social normal way. Okay. So enlightened person transcended the social norms, like we said, he let go the raft, right? You don't need to keep your sila. I don't know why you wouldn't do that, but you know, teaching others, you're actually example. People have existed in all societies. There's actually quite a famous one. Ajahn Brahm sometimes quotes this Nasruddin.
Nasruddin. Mm.
Interesting character, and whether there's just stories about Nasruddin, you know, there's interesting stories. I think he was a Sufi saint. He was doing these interesting things where one time there's a story about Nasruddin. He was looking for a ring. He dropped his ring inside his house, And he couldn't find it, so he went to the backyard looking for the ring. And the, I think maybe it was wife. I said, why did you go to the backyard looking for the ring? I thought you lost it inside the house. He said, well, there wasn't enough light in the house, so I went backyard. There's a lot more light there. So right, so there's quite often these people are associated with this kind of wisdom, which is goes against. It's like it's really something different. Is it mental disease? Are they like village idiots? Maybe sometimes. Sometimes it's hard to say with even places like, I don't know Sri Lanka, Burma, but I know in Thailand I've met some interesting monks. And they
interesting in quotation marks?
I don't find them very... But in the sense that they project, they almost like they get really close to telling that they are enlightened, and then they behave in certain ways which we wouldn't do. We wouldn't behave. We are quite certain social norms we behave, as a monk we behave a certain way, and they sort of go against the stream just to show that there's something different. Are they really enlightened, or they just maybe they have mental disease? Who knows?
Yeah,
it's hard to say sometimes. It really is. And divine madness is typical for people who want the fruit of the religion but not its obligations. I think that this is quite interesting to look at this way. I maybe not even this in that depth, but quite often people even in Buddhism, they want the fruit of the religion. You want the fruits. You want stillness, like what we teach, stillness, jhanas, or your meditation experiences, whatever. You want to have mind which is still, but you don't want to have obligations. You don't want to have sila. You don't want to live this kind of lifestyle. I just want to just live normal life, but I want to have all these experiences. So you want to have the fruit of the religion, but not obliged to anything. Is it going to work? Don't know. Maybe not. Right. A few more things. Okay, so quite often this is sort of higher wisdom. I was part of the Tibetan groups in the beginning. I was just meditating with anybody beginning, and there's good teachers there. I'm not saying anything bad, even Trungpa Rinpoche himself or there's any groups, but quite often there is this idea that, okay, we teach, this is a higher wisdom. And even Theravada Buddhism, we have a higher Dhamma, where some monks teach a higher Dhamma. And this is sort of like the preliminary teachings, what we're doing. Is it? Maybe. But you don't really want to commit to the path, right? Again, you want to have a higher wisdom. You want to be, it's one of those things in you want to be really wise. People, you want to be other people seeing you as the guru. You want other people like, oh, he's really wise. It's really, that would be cool, wouldn't it? You don't want to just disappear. What's the point of that? Anyway, so quite often they have been taught that you get to the higher wisdom if you commit to this way of teaching. And the breakthrough comes in quick succession, quickly if you follow this path. And the teacher, guru, will shock them into understanding certain things. Quite often, you hear these things.
So this is how many factors does this path have?
It doesn't need that many.
One it's factor, the guru.
One factor.
The guru factor.
Like,
okay.
Yeah, guru factor.
Guru factor, okay.
So there's this shock. You do certain practices, or the teacher even, that's why the teacher is so important in these kind of traditions. They try to shock you into this understanding. You don't really need to do that much. You just commit yourself into that teacher. and there's a tremendous danger there. You're not really thinking for yourself. You are handing yourself, like your will, to another. So there's a lot of danger in that. And one of the things where quite often these kind of what Ajahn Pramali was saying as well, not just Buddhism, but the other teachers in other traditions, and say that you should or you can indulge in, example, for alcohol and sex. Quite often that follows into this kind of, because why not? It sounds really cool. And then what happens? Other people have to pick up the pieces of people's mental problems afterwards. So is it leading to peace? Is it really leading to a calm mind? Is it leading to wholesome mind? That's why there was a question earlier, how do you decide what's wisdom? Is it really leading to this kind of wholesome mind where you don't have to worry about in your own mind when you sit down? There's no doubt in your mind. Is it leading to that direction, or is it leading more into indulgence? You can decide for yourself.
I would be much stronger about this than you are. I mean, to me, it is obvious that if someone has this sort of wisdom, they don't have any wisdom at all. You know, Chogyam Trungpa, who you showed on the picture before, he is quite widely accepted as having been abusive and alcoholic. Obviously he was actually a scandalous person rather than someone who was even remotely enlightened. Mm. He had a certain charisma. He was a bit into attract a following. And so he had the famous Labha Sakkara Siloka, gain, honor, and fame. He got those things. And a lot of people, I think, in that position, they are trapped by these things. Maybe they haven't got it together otherwise in their lives, so they just love the kind of the attention they get and the things that they Rolls Royces or whatever it is that they kind of acquire. They love that. So to me, all of these things that you have just mentioned is the signs precisely that they're not enlightened. I don't think there's any doubt about that, that these people are not enlightened. If you indulge in these kind of things and these kind of things, it's obviously the case, and you should be in those. These are precisely the signs that you should look out for, to be careful and to be wary of people, and not even, I don't think you should actually even think, oh, maybe this person is enlightened. I think straight away you should be very wary when these things happen. You shouldn't judge too quickly, because it can be hard to judge. You should be a little bit careful. But generally speaking, these are precisely the signs that you should be on the lookout for. So I would prefer to be much,
sure,
much more.
My answer is actually coming on the next
is it?
Slide.
Oh, really? Okay.
No, I know where you're coming from. No, you just wanted to make the point.
I'm just afraid that people kind of get the wrong, right. Especially a beginner might get the wrong ideas about this. And that's really...
Where I'm coming from is that what did the Buddha actually say about these things? And my next slides are going to say what is actually person who gets further on the path, what are the characteristics of these kind of people? Right, let's see. Is it indulging in these things or not? So what does the Buddha say? Okay, so I'm going to give you now certain qualities which you person you can expect to growth, not decline. So let's see what the Buddha says about person who's spiritually advanced or who's growing in the path. So person who has faith, faithful individual doesn't decline. Saddo. So faith, again, you could sadda, you could translate as a confident person who's gaining confidence, is on a path. You have to have a certain amount of faith in the beginning that, okay, there seems to be something to this, these teachings. You read the teachings, even just basic teachings, Anicca Dukkha Anatta. These basic teachings of the Buddha, or some of these things what we've been teaching today, last 2 weeks, that the Noble Eightfold Path, that, okay, there's something to that. So you have to have a little bit of faith in the beginning, and then the confidence grows. Individual with consciousness doesn't decline.
Conscious, sorry.
Hirima. That's an interesting word, isn't it? You have a hiri. You want to say something about when having a conscious, you have a...
Conscience.
Conscience.
Yeah.
Hiri.
sometimes here it is translated as shame.
Shame, yeah.
Yeah, it's like, for example, it is the idea of having a, being like dressed or having a cloth to cover yourself up. It's like connected with hirima sometimes in the suttas. So it's like having a sense of shame that you have a kind of internal compass that drives you roughly right. So conscience, yeah, the fact that you feel bad about yourself if you don't do the right thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So again, the Buddha is saying something completely different about than what these divine madness people are sometimes teaching or how they are behaving. Mm. A prudent individual doesn't decline. Otapi, this is definitely, I don't not really don't know that.
That word, you usually, otapam, is that you have you are concerned about the consequences of your actions. This has to do with understanding kamma or understanding straight away the, you know, what this consequence, what it leads to if you do these kind of things. That's otapa, often translated, I think, as fear of consequences.
Right.
But he says prudent, because precisely because prudent means that, you know, you are, you understand the consequences, so you hold back, you're prudent about how you live, so as to avoid avoid bad consequences. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just to remind again, so these are what you should be developing, what you should be looking out for, good monks and nuns, when they have these qualities, and you, you know, personally you should live up to this standard. Okay. So energetic individual doesn't decline. Aradhavirio. What does it mean? Yeah, another one. Energetic. What does it mean? You have to have a lot of coffee? You have just go for the, you know, meditate all the time.
Yeah.
Stay up all night to meditate. Where's the energy going into this in here?
I would say that you know, energy in Buddhism is the natural energy of the mind. Yeah, so this is the ideal energy. It doesn't mean that you necessarily exert yourself a lot and you sit up all night and all the kind of thing, but that means that your mind is energetic. It's like if you have a positive mind which is well developed in morality and you kind of have a, maybe getting some joy from the suttas and the word of the Buddha, then the energy comes with that. So it's more like the natural energy. It doesn't mean that you necessarily exert yourself very hard. So this is the ideal energy,
right,
where you just have that brightness of the mind. Yeah.
Brightness of the mind.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
The word there, the aradha.
Aradha means just to establish or to,
oh,
get,
establish.
To start,
oh, okay.
Start energy, to get energy going.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
I didn't know that. Yeah. Right. A wise individual doesn't decline. Panyava, that's a nice word. Panyava, wise, we have wisdom in the teachings. What do you want to, what can you say about that? I know, they're my slides, but
I mean, you know, wise just means that you, In the lesser, I mean, wisdom is a very broad word in Pali. It means everything from, you know, just a person who is kind and who keeps morality, they would be considered wise.
Oh, really?
You have your wise, I mean, that's what it's, how it's defined in the Balapandita Sutta, Majjhima 129. It talks about the fools and the wise people. And then the wise person is very simple, someone who lives well and they get good rebirth as a consequence of living well. Yeah. So that is kind of the lesser wisdom, yeah, the smaller wisdom.
Oh, right, yeah.
And then it goes all the way up to the wisdom, which is the wisdom of arahantship. And everything in between is wisdom to some extent. You are acting in accordance with the path, developing the path in the right way, and also the results of the path.
Right.
So it's a very broad term. Yeah.
So you even just say kind person is a wise person?
Well, to some extent, yeah. I mean, not super wise yet, but a little bit wiser, not utterly.
But that would
foolish.
Be wisdom, sort of, and the opposite of, you know, and having a person who's not kind, who's acting ill will, it's not actually not wisdom.
That would be considered a foolish person. Yeah.
Loving individual doesn't decline, a good dhano. Okay, so with this is interesting. Like, what's the difference between this and metta?
Kodana means angry. So this literally means a non-angry person.
Ah, okay.
Literally, yeah.
But is this just metta and this is just similes to each other?
Yeah, it's probably a bit broader than metta, because if you don't have anger, you could have upekkha, for example.
Right.
Could be neutral. There was
okay.
So,
we have this and then, I forget the word. Never mind. Mm. Okay.
Mm.
A kind individual doesn't decline. Anupanahi. Okay, kind. Yeah. You always have to remember all of these things, lovingness, you know, kindness, all that. It also, it's for your own mind, own body, and others as well. Individual with few desires doesn't decline. Apichato. Apicho. So what is this, like few desires? So you are restraining yourself? You are, what does it mean? I understand that with the monks, but yeah. What does it mean for lay people?
Yeah, it just means that you are reasonably content. Yeah, you
contentment. Don't
have, yeah,
okay.
Contentment is the, like apichato.
That's
yeah,
true, actually.
Apicho. Yeah.
Contentment.
Yeah.
I like word contentment. Yeah. Mm. Yeah. Actually, yeah, I just remembered that Ajahn Brahm likes to translate these days abhicho in the contentment. Didn't no? What did he say? No. That was upeka.
Upeka. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
An individual with good friends doesn't decline. So these were one of the starting factors for the path, right? For the Noble Eightfold Path, with good friends, meaning people who are know the path, and then you follow them. People who have no Dhamma, Buddha, the Sangha, hopefully,
yeah,
the Arya Sangha, if you can find.
How do you? Yeah, exactly.
How do you define good friends?
How do you find the Arya Sangha? Is that, yeah.
You follow them around and see if they're behaving
yeah.
well.
Yeah, yeah, but you have to be wise to be able to see, right? It's kind of a catch-22.
It is a little bit, but yeah. you slowly you come to a conclusion like we've been maybe long enough and we can point to the way.
Yeah.
Ajahn Brahm points the way and the suttas point the way.
Buddha points the way. Yeah.
Puna points the way. Mm. Yeah, so you, all of these things, yeah? So you find good friends. And the individual with right view doesn't decline. Well, this is a bit more difficult. But we are coming to the right view later on today. A little bit, we're going to talk about a little bit next week, actually. Well, it's the right view, but...
Yeah. But it's interesting. So I think one of the questions before was, how do you know that you have right view? Mm. And how can you actually know this? And how do you make the distinction between right view and wrong view? And the answer is, you can't really know. Yeah, it's very difficult to know that. So... A lot of the path is really to kind of uncover things. You start out with what you have. You have maybe a little bit of faith in the Dhamma. You have a little bit of practice going. Mm. And then gradually, as you investigate, you kind of uncover things and your view gradually gets straightened out with the practice.
Yep.
It's a process. And of course, the whole purpose, the whole problem with delusion is precisely that delusion means you cannot actually know whether you have that right view or not.
Because you're deluded.
So gradually you kind of, it's like you unwind, and you always have to be kind of open mind. Try to be open-minded about things. And then gradually kind of, you know, things tend to come into balance and come into the right way. But that is definitely difficult.
And it's interesting with that as well, like instead of, you know, you're slowly straining to right view and you're coming into the understanding this is how we should be practicing.
Mm.
We don't try to shock you into the understanding.
Yeah, that is a dangerous kind of thing.
Yeah.
That's where you start having guru worship, and the guru kind of, you know, has a lot of influence over you if you do that.
Whoever has faith, conscience, prudence, energy, and wisdom. When it comes to skillful qualities, can expect the growth, not decline in skillful qualities, whether by day or by night. And so these are one of the things which I'm saying that the Buddha was teaching.
Yep.
He wasn't saying the divine madness. This is sort of like sometimes you see these things.
Yeah.
And they're protected on these teachers, or historically there's, you know, and there's plenty of stories though, even in all the Buddhist traditions.
Mm.
But this is what the Buddha was saying, that this, how can you decide what's a good teacher, and how can you grow yourself?
Yeah. Yeah, so divine madness is like crazy wisdom.
It's crazy.
The other word for
it's
it.
It's absolutely crazy.
Yeah, but the reality is that either you're crazy or you're wise, not both at the same time.
Right, they don't come together.
That's kind of what you're saying here, I guess.
Okay. Yeah. So I remember being in a retreat with one group, and then I said, It was a Tibetan group, and I said, "Oh yeah, well, it's all good. This Tibetan practices this and that, but I like the Theravada teaching." I said, "Oh, Theravada Buddhism is so boring." I said, "Yeah, no, I'm sorry." So we sort of teach you boring things, maybe, but we're trying to skillfully sort of tread into this getting happier and happier minds, which is. Which you can easily let go, not just to shock you into understanding. What's next?
I think that's it for this part. Oh, that one. Oh, okay, yeah. Yeah.
Okay, must be who I've done it again. So this is a person who's come to the close to the end of the path.
So this is the real practitioner.
This is a real practitioner. And this could be a real teacher as well, where you get your kindness from.
Hmm.
I think it's your turn.
Let's have a meditation break.
Good.
That's what I say. Okay. So that is the enlightened person, perhaps. I'm not sure. I'm not entirely sure. But maybe on the path. So is there any questions at this point? Yes, could you please use the microphone, Nicholas?
Ajahn, the reference in Anguttara Nikaya, does that cover all of the ones that were displayed?
I didn't hear, sorry.
The reference that you had for the Anguttara, does it include all the things that you displayed? Does it include all the previous things you were talking about?
Oh, sorry, yes. Oh, that's what you're asking. Yeah, this is the whole sutta. This is just a recap at the end of the sutta. So the sequence is actually there, and this is the end of that.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Anyone else want to say anything? Yeah. All quiet, all silent. Okay. Does that mean that you agree? Or, yeah? Okay. It's interesting, this whole idea of crazy wisdom. And I think it's very important to be aware of this sort of thing, because it's so easy to be kind of drawn into a cult and be taken for a ride and be ripped off and be abused even, if you're not careful with who you deal with. So it actually matters enormously. But if you are in a kind of proper, good environment where people do things in the right way, then the whole idea of the spiritual path is to lift you up, to make you feel better, to make you a better person, and all of these things. It should really be something very uplifting and very beautiful. And often this great, wonderful potential is then used against people instead and drags people down and is so incredibly destructive. So I think it's a very, very important point. So thank you for bringing that up. And I'm kind of like this now. I think I had too much coffee today.
I think
I finally reached my limit.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, you finally reached. I think that the thing with people, we have enough problems in our life and from the past that this should be more like a healing path. What we're teaching is trying to create more problems.
Yeah. Mm.
It's hard enough to let go of what we have already.
Yeah.
Then to have more problems.
Exactly. So I have good news for you. We have now finished with all the misconceptions. So we have, that was the last one we're going to talk about. And now what I want to do now is to move forward, and we're going to start to talk about the actual Noble Eightfold Path. Yeah, the factors of the path. So finally getting there. So this is just the kind of the main heading. This is where we're supposed to get for the last session. But now I want to talk about right view. And we only have a little bit of time left. So what we're going to do is just talk about right view from an overview of right view. Yeah, I guess. Okay. Overview of right view. We're going to have an overview of right view and not kind of get into the details. So we're going to talk about the details of what it is and how it arises and what it leads to. Next time, but this is just to give you a little bit of background. It's getting late now anyway, it's been a long day, and even if you had as much coffee as I have, still it kind of, there's a kind of a limit to how much you can take in, I suppose. So let's have a little bit of look at right view. And this is, there's a lot of things that you could pick out in the suttas, but this little saying here is quite nice. Wrong view is non-dhamma, right view is the Dhamma. Yeah, it's almost as if you can summarize the idea of right view as being the Dhamma. In other words, almost everything in Buddhism kind of arises out of the idea of right view. The path starts off with right view. It's what gets you going, the idea that you understand things in such a way that you start to become more kind, you start to become more mindful, you start to practice meditation or whatever. Yeah, all arises from right view. At the very beginning of the path, that's where it comes from. Even if you never really thought about right view and you just kind of practiced well already, well, that comes from a natural kind of right view that you may have bring with you from a past life or whatever. And of course, it goes all the way to the end of the path, all the way to the very end. That also is kind of when right view becomes kind of absolutely solidified in you. So the whole path can be regarded as this. The whole of Dhamma can be regarded as right view. Yeah, the Buddha arising in the world is like right view arising in the world, and then right view becoming available to other people as a consequence of the Buddha having it. So it's kind of nice, the fact that this is what the Dhamma is all about. So let's look at some of the features of right view. And this is from the Samma Ditti Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 9. And this has a kind of a nice idea of what right view, one way of looking or thinking about right view. When, friends, a noble disciple understands the unwholesome and the root of the unwholesome, the wholesome and the root of the wholesome, in that way he is one of right view, whose view is straight, who has unwavering confidence in the Dhamma, and who has arrived at this true Dhamma. Yeah, so this is one of many definitions in the Samma Ditti Sutta of the idea of right view. And here it is talked about in terms of the unwholesome and the wholesome. So you understand what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. And you may think that that is kind of obvious. Yeah, if you are kind, you're wholesome. If you're not kind, it's unwholesome. But of course, to fully understand that is quite difficult. And one of the consequences of not understanding it fully is that your meditation tends to stop at a certain level. You meditate, you become peaceful, but then somehow it doesn't go any deeper. And that is always the big question. Why doesn't it go any further? Why does it stop at a certain point? You may be enjoying yourself, you may be peaceful, you may be getting some joy coming up in your meditation, you may be hanging out with your breath, but then why doesn't it go deeper? It's one of those really fundamental questions. Yeah, if we can answer that, then we will know what is required. So what is the reason? And the reason is because you don't understand this. Yeah, you don't understand the defilements that are there that block you from going more deeply. And these are specifically, you know, most importantly, things like holding on to things in the sensory world. Yeah, this is one of the most obvious things that stop you from going deeper, not being willing to let go of your senses, which you have at a certain point. And these kind of things are the things that block you. So this is like almost like a continuous process of uncovering the unwholesome, understanding what it is, and understanding what the wholesome is. And when you become a stream mentor, this is why the stream mentor has given up the fetter of vichikicca. Vichikicca being doubt, yeah? Why? Because the stream mentor has right view. They know what is wholesome, what is unwholesome. That is the definition of vichikicca. You don't have any doubt as to what is wholesome and what is unwholesome. So these things go kind of hand in hand, yeah? Because now you know what liberation is, you know the whole path, and you are able to fully distinguish the wholesome qualities of existence from the unwholesome ones. You also understand the roots of these things. In other words, you understand the mental motivation that drives unwholesome qualities, the greed, the ill will, the delusion, and all of that. Yeah, it's pretty cool to be a stream mentor. It's good news, isn't it? Now you know. You know what you have to do and what you don't have to do. You have full kind of overview over your own mind. You understand your own mind fully, the wholesome and the unwholesome qualities. So it's very handy to be a stream mentor. It's recommended by the Buddha, right? we all recommend that. So, you know, if you can be a stream mentor, please be a stream mentor. If you can't, then just gradually. Yeah, that's kind of the idea here. So this is one way. There's many other ways of looking at the idea of stream mentor. This is one way of thinking about this. So in this way, you are one who has right view. Another way would be you understand dependent origination. Yeah, that's another way of right view. And this is kind of the other factors of this one. Understanding the Four Noble Truths, understanding whatever. These are just different angles all on the same thing. The same thing is the picture called the Dhamma, this famous jigsaw puzzle again. And it is also called one whose views is straight. Ujju, this beautiful Pali word, ujju, it is straight, it is not crooked. The defilements are called the crookednesses of the mind. The mind is straight, it aligns with the way things actually are, with the reality. It is not doesn't contradict that. It is this kind of the straight, upright mind. Interesting, the Pali word ujju is rujju in Sanskrit, and it is directly related to the English words right and the English word straight. Yeah, these are the same etymology. They come from the same root. So they are actually related to each other. I really love these kind of things. Yeah, we can see how close our world is together in a sense. How kind of how much we have in common because of languages and all of this kind of thing. There isn't all that much separation between us. This is ancient India 2,500 years ago. And the words they use are the same words we use now. Ruju and straight, same word. Kind of fascinating, isn't it? And so that is the idea of straight. Yeah, your view is straight, it heads in the right direction, it's not crooked. And you have unwavering confidence in the Dhamma. And this is one of the things I've been, you know, talking about before here already, the idea that the confidence and right view, the confidence and wisdom in Buddhism, saddha and panya, saddha and samadhi, all of these things are just different angles on the same thing. Why do we have confidence in something? Why do we have faith in Buddhism? Well, because we understand that there's some truth to this. Yeah, confidence here is based on the sense that there's something right in what the Buddha is explaining. It's not a kind of blind confidence, a confidence that arises from insight. The deeper the insight is, the greater your confidence is. When you see things fully, of course, your confidence is going to be complete. Complete confidence is unwavering confidence. They go together. And of course, when you have that unwavering confidence of faith, it is similar to kind of having, then of course you also get the joy and happiness that comes from that, because you understand that you have uncovered this beautiful treasure inside of yourself, this marvelous treasure that always leads towards greater contentment, greater happiness, greater wisdom, away from suffering, away from all the problems in life. Yeah, this is the kind of the most powerful treasure you can find. And you think, wow. You know, sometimes we get excited. Yeah, I got a promotion. Yeah, I got a promotion. Yeah, in my job or whatever. Yeah, I got into a new relationship. Oh, my new partner. Wow, so wonderful. Why do we feel happy when these things happen? I got a salary increase. Yay. You know, now I earned, I don't know what. Yeah, we get so happy when these things happen to us. But it's nothing. Yeah, you have it's zilch compared to what you uncover in the Dhamma. If you really, the reason why we're happy about those things is because we think it will bring us happiness. But it will bring us a tiny bit of happiness if we're lucky. This is what really brings us happiness. If we should be happy and joyous about anything, it's about the Dhamma, not about the tiny little gains we have in ordinary life. This is where real happiness is to be found. And yet, what do we rejoice in? What do we feel elated by? It is the little tiny gains in ordinary life. We get things so wrong, yeah? Isn't that kind of interesting? And the reason is because we don't really understand what the Dhamma is. We're not able to properly compare it to ordinary worldly happiness. If we really knew what was going on, if we'd read the Dhamma, think, wow, this is it. And we feel so happy to sit down and bliss out in meditation as a consequence. This is really what this is about. This is real confidence, real faith. And these are the emotions that come from that real confidence and faith. And the last one, you have arrived at the true Dhamma. This means that you are a stream entry. Yeah, you have arrived there, you have acquired, you have got the Sammaditti. You are called Dittipatto. Dittipatto, Ditti is view. Patto is attained. You have attained the view of reality. You see things as they actually are for the first time. Arrived at the Dhamma. You are there. You are in the kind of the, now the Noble Eightfold Path has been internalized. You have no choice but to carry on the Noble Eightfold Path. You have arrived in the real departure lounge and now heading towards Nibbana at full speed from here on.
Only one thing I want to say, so it just reminds me of that you were talking about the, wow, this is the Dhamma.
Yeah.
Dhammapada verse 79, if I remember correctly. Dhammapiti sukhangseti. Mm-hmm. Something, you know, there's more to that, the verse there, but maybe you can translate that for us.
Dhammapiti
sukhangseti.
Sukhangseti.
Yeah.
Sukhangseti. Seti?
I think, I don't know. Sometimes they translate that as...
Seta, seti. Maybe the best. Maybe it means the best.
Yeah.
Happiness is the best. Sukhangseti. Yeah. or the best of happiness, maybe.
Yeah.
The best. Dhamma pity just means the pity of the Dhamma, the joy of the Dhamma.
It could be that you drink the Dhamma.
Yeah.
Quite often translated.
Dhamma
you,
pity,
when
yeah.
You, when you drink the Dhamma, you gain happiness.
Uh-huh.
No, it just, you know, came from that pity. When you talk about it, it's like, wow, this is the Dhamma. The pity, you know, instead of, you know, drinking, or you gain that kind of wow factor. You uplift your mind.
Yeah.
You're drinking the Dhamma, but it uplifts your mind, and that brings you happiness.
Mm.
I like that verse.
Yeah, exactly. This is so interesting that, you know, that if you really understand this, it is so uplifting and so beautiful. And this is why that distinction between confidence and faith doesn't really exist in Buddhism. You have the idea of Dhamma Veda and Atta Veda. And Dhamma, and this word Veda is the same word that you find in Vedana, and also the same word you find in Vidya. And Vidya is profound knowledge on the path. And Vedana is feeling. Yeah, and it kind of merges those two meanings into one word, Dhamma Veda. So when you have Dhamma Veda, you have both the understanding, the which is like the wisdom factor, and also the feeling that comes with it. So it has both confidence and faith kind of merging together. And that's why Dhamma Veda is sometimes called inspiration in the Dhamma. Because inspiration is like, you both understand, think, wow. But inspiration is also a very positive feeling. Yeah, wow, I'm inspired. Wow, this is really nice. And so inspiration in the Dhamma, Atta Veda, inspiration in the meaning, or the goal, where the Dhamma is going. Yeah, and then that becomes then the foundation for meditation practice. And this is exactly what this is. And then you carry on. The piti comes, the pasaddi. Piti is the joy. Pasaddi is the calm. From the calm comes the sukha. And from the sukha comes the samadhi. Yeah, and then the whole sequence unfolds like that. Okay. So this is the beautiful sutta, the Sammaditti Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 9, and this is actually all spoken by Venerable Sariputta, and that's why it says friends rather than monks or nuns at the top. So let's go on to the next one. Monks, I do not see even a single thing because of which, with the breakup of the body after death, beings are reborn in a good destination in the heavenly world, so much as right view. Yeah, so right view is really important for your rebirth. This is from the Anguttara Nikaya 1.3.1.3. And so the idea of right view really matters. But it's interesting, why does right view matter so much? Yeah, this is one of those things. It may look like from this that if right view is enough, if you behave like a complete scallywag, a dodgy character, as long as you have right view, you're in business. Yeah, you're going straight straight to the Tusita realm or whatever. But it's not quite as simple as that. The point is that right view has consequences, yeah? And that is why it leads to such a good destination. So these are the consequences right here. And this is really the full explanation of why right view matters so much. So these beings who were ill-conducted in body, speech, and mind, abusers of the noble ones, wrong in their views, acting in accordance with their wrong view, on the dissolution of the body after death, they have reappeared in a bad destination, even in hell. Yeah, so this is kind of the idea of wrong view. It's not just that wrong view in itself is bad, but it has consequences. If you really have wrong view, you will act in accordance with that view. If you have wrong view, but you don't act in accordance with it, well, you don't really have wrong view, because there's something that's stopping you from acting in accordance with it. So if you really have wrong view, it means almost by definition that you will act in accordance with it. And that is the problem. You can see here, yeah, bad conduct, body, speech, and mind. It's interesting one, the abusers of the noble ones. Yeah, if you are someone who abuses, arahants, yeah, or the Buddha maybe. There's examples in the sutta of someone abusing the Buddha. Or you abuse anyone who has right view in this way. So you have to be careful. If people are really good people, you have to be careful with how you behave around them. It's kind of interesting that is specifically mentioned here. And then the fact that you act in accordance with the wrong view. So wrong view is very powerful because it kind of, it has all these consequences in how we live. Yeah, and that is why it matters so enormously. So the more established you are in the right way of thinking, the more you will tend to live in accordance with that. So we need to establish right view. Yeah, bang, strongly. How do you get right view? Read the suttas, yeah? Read the word of the Buddha. This the Buddha Vajna is what matters for right view. So that is, the, you know, I always like to say that the Sutta Pitaka, it's about this long in printed edition, or if you get it on a memory stick, it's tiny, tiny, but, you know, it is. There's a lot in there, and it is just one mass of right view. It's good, isn't it? One mass, 5,000 pages of right view, yeah, from beginning to end. Maybe there's a couple of dodgy things in there which were kind of because of, you know, typos and that kind of stuff. So if you get a typo, you have a problem because you don't have the word of the Buddha anymore. But apart from those dodgy typos, yeah, you have 5,000 pages of right view. That is really what the suttas are. They're just a mass of right view. So this is why it matters to read them. So this here is directly from the suttas, by the way. I forgot to say that. This is from the, when you look at the Te Vidya, the three true knowledges, yeah? The three true knowledges are the knowledge of the recollection of past lives, the recollection of understanding kamma. This is the understanding of kamma, yeah, from that. And the last one is arahantship, when you understand the Four Noble Truths. So this is directly from the suttas. This, I think, taken from Majjhima Nikaya number 4. So, do you like this? Yeah? Is it good? Yeah? It's good, right? I don't know. I really love this. I find it's really, it's so rich. Yeah, there's so much in there. So, I don't know. And so this is where you kind of get the right view. So, and then we have the opposite. Yeah? But these beings who were well conducted in body, speech, and mind, not revilers or abusers of the noble ones, right in their views, acting accordance with their right view, on the dissolution of the body after death, have reappeared in a good destination, even in the heavenly world. Majjhima Nikaya 4. This is the opposite. When you have right view, you tend to live in accordance with that right view. This is what this is about. Okay, so this is just a superficial understanding of right view, what the consequences of right view are, even at the very early stages of what we call Buddhist practice, even if you just want to have a good rebirth, even if you just want to get reborn in the human realm in a good way, right view is going to be very helpful. Yeah, even if we don't talk about the path in a deeper sense, but just the preliminary aspects of rebirth, right view is already very helpful. This is just to show you the broad consequences of right view. It is very broadly helpful. And then another consequence of right view. Monks, just as the dawn is the forerunner and precursor of the sunrise, so right view is the forerunner and precursor of wholesome qualities. Yeah, if you have right view, you can expect to have wholesome qualities. Yeah? When you look around the Buddha society here and you see all the good people in the Buddha society, you realize there's a lot of people who have right view, at least to some extent. Yeah? That's why people are good people. Otherwise, it wouldn't be good people. So this is a beautiful thing. I don't know. I often... It's nice to come to the Buddhist society, yeah, when you come here and you meet wholesome people. I think it's one of those wonderful things to be able to have such kalanamittas wherever you go, or wherever you're part of this Buddhist society. Yeah. So you know that the people here, to the extent that they are good people, and that's pretty high extent, they also have right view to that extent. So, again, it shows you the importance of then studying the suttas. Yeah, continuing to establish right view. Remember, right view, we'll talk about this more later on, but right view is not either you have it or you don't. You have degrees of it. Yeah, you start off, you have a little bit of right view, starting to keep the precepts, etc. And then you get more right view, thinking, yeah, maybe I should be even kinder. So you become even kinder. And then you think, yeah, maybe you get more right view. Maybe I should try to think in a better way. Yeah, and then you get even more right view. Maybe I should practice some meditation and watch the breath, and you get more right view. And every time you practice the path better, the right view increases. And whenever right view increases, you tend to practice the path better. Yeah, going hand in hand in this way. So right view is always kind of improving as you understand the path in this way. Okay. Monks, I do not see even a single thing on account of which unarisen wholesome qualities arise, and arisen wholesome qualities increase and expand so much as right view. It's pretty powerful. There's nothing else, yeah? No single thing that is more important for the wholesome qualities to arise and unwholesome qualities to, also unwholesome qualities to decline, by the way. I didn't include that sutta because there was just too much information, I thought. Yeah, again, it shows you the very fundamental importance of right view. This is the thing that really makes the whole thing work. Nothing else is more important than this. You could look at this from different angles. You could look at this from the angle of, you know, yoniso manasikara, which is like proper attention or wise attention, is very closely related to right view. Essentially, all these qualities that come together with right view, this is what really makes the path happen and give rise to wholesome qualities. Right view slants, slopes, and inclines towards Nibbana. Yeah, if you have right view, you are inclining towards Nibbana. It's pretty nice, isn't it? So if you are reading the suttas, you are developing your right view, you're trying to see the world in the right way, it means you too, everyone, maybe everyone here, yeah, is inclining towards Nibbana. Nice, isn't it? And this is kind of what we, this is the whole point. What is Nibbana? And well, Nibbana is the highest happiness. So why not incline towards the highest happiness? It kind of makes sense. Anyway, so that is just a introduction for you about right view, just to get us started on that. And next time, we're going to look at the right view in much more detail and also how it connects with right intention, the two first factors. This is just to kind of give you a little bit of whet your appetite for right view. So, did you would like to add anything, Venerable?
No, I think some questions online and all that. So I think
we
can let people go if they want to. It was a long day, I think, for everybody. I think, but I enjoyed a lot. I think it was fun.
Yeah,
it was nice to be with you, Ajahn Bhumali.
Was it okay? Very glad to be with you.
And and if there's questions, people, if you want to go home, please
ask some questions now.
We'll do the online, and if please use the microphone if you ask questions.
Let's allow people. Should allow people here to do first because they
are. Okay, that's good. Might as well.
Yeah. So, yeah, please.
I was just continuing wondering about the right view being a requisite for right samadhi. So when the Buddha was, 10 years old and he got into samadhi sitting under that rose apple tree, is that because in previous life he had very strong jhana practice because he probably didn't have right view at that early stage?
Yeah, I would say yes. I mean, he probably had the right view at that stage. That's the whole point. But the right view was something he inherited from a previous existence. He hadn't developed that right view in that life. But he probably would have brought it with him as a habit, from a previous life. Yeah, and that's the thing. If you develop good meditation in this life, you will take that with you into your next life. Your mind will already have those qualities there, and then you bring them with you. So obviously the Buddha would have, for whatever reason, he would have developed meditation in the past, not as part of a bodhisattva path, but just merely because of conditions made him practice in the right way. And then it happened to him, yeah.
That's exactly that. You do take something next to a next lifetime. Meditation, that habit is one of them, yeah.
Yeah.
It's such a strong imprint in your mind.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And even this lifetime, if you have strong meditation, that you remember that it's almost like a feeling, and that will actually next time you're meditating, it will actually take you, the happiness of that will take you again into the quite often will take you to the deeper stages again. It's interesting. The happiness
just
is so strong.
Just the memory almost of
memory
that previous
almost.
Meditation can take you.
Yeah,
the
memory of that happiness is so strong that just contemplating of the deep meditation or the deep happiness will just bring the happiness again. It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah. Anyone else like to say anything? Make any
complaints?
Comments or whatever you would like. Everyone is completely, either you're very content or you're completely zonked out. So I'm not sure which one. But okay.
Okay, there's actually just one question from online, from Singapore. Do we need mindfulness to have metta? Do we need to have mindfulness?
Do you need mindfulness to have metta?
I think you do. Quite often we forget these things. If you take mindfulness to mean that, have a sati in that sense, it's like, oh, hang on, I'm depressed, I am nervous, whatever. I was quite nervous this afternoon. I don't know, something happened with my medication or something. I was really feeling nervous. What comes to my mind? Instead of fighting it, just have metta. And so you don't fight these things. Depression, something, whatever you have a lot of doubt in your mind. We all have this, stage which we want to push away from your mind quite often. That's a normal attitude towards that. The sati should come, the mindfulness should come. Hang on. No. That's the wrong way of doing it. Buddha didn't actually teach that. The Buddha thought accepting, loving kindness, all these positive qualities. And then it's easier to live with that. Yes, you need to have some, quite often you need to have memory. You need to have the, that's what I need to be practicing. Metta. Yeah.
Yeah.
We tend to forget.
Mm. I think it's true. It goes both ways, really. You need mindfulness to have metta because you need to be aware of where your mind is now so you can direct it in the right way. And also you need, as you said, the memory to remind you of the teachings. But you also need metta to have mindfulness. The more metta you have, the more kindness you have to the world around you, the more naturally mindful you're going to be because you want to be in the present moment. The present moment is the pleasant moment, as Ajahn Brahm likes to say. Make the present moment the pleasant moment. If you have metta, you want to be in the present. Where else? Because it feels happy and you are enjoying it. So it goes both ways. Mindfulness, you need mindfulness and metta, you need metta to have full mindfulness. So they build each other up and they work together. Yeah.
Interesting thing about metta also, which quite often is forgotten, metta and self doesn't really live in the same house. The more metta you have, the less of self is there. So it's actually, you have this feeling of loving kindness, but more you will disappear. So it's interesting that you always remember, you can also remember that having loving kindness is you are more with that feeling. It's like when we have the simile of the mother having loving kindness towards the baby. The mother is sort of just thinking of the baby and forgetting themselves, and it just there's this beautiful feeling about the metta. So the stronger metta you have, the less you are there. I thought it was.
So it's nice, yeah. I know exactly what it means. That's very nice, and it means that the self is a. Because metta feels so nice, it means that the self is a pain in the backside.
Yep. Some quite often.
Quite often, yeah. Gets
but it's a really great antidote, really is. And you just to, have that in your toolbox and remember you have to use it. Otherwise, there's no point.
Mm. Mm. Like a hammer.
Like a hammer.
No, wait a minute. That doesn't work.
Almost like that.
Almost like
metta
hammer. Yeah. Okay, any last questions or comments? Okay, Ariel.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you.
If you work for an organization or an employer who doesn't necessarily have the right view, does this mean that you are not practicing right livelihood? Can you comment on that, please?
Okay, well, that is a bit like Nalin was talking about earlier on today, because Nalin, who is sitting next to you actually, he was saying that, well, in the world, there is so much, so many bad things happening in the corporate world, and there's bribery and there's all kind of things. And if you're part of that world, how can you have right livelihood when you're part of that kind of sphere? And that's a bit like you are asking now, Ariel. And the answer is that you have to see, you know, it's not necessarily wrong in itself to work for that organization as long as you are able to do the right thing within that organization. Yeah. I mean, it depends on how much you are contributing to the corruption. If you feel that you are contributing a lot, then maybe it's not so good. But generally speaking, your job is just to look after yourself. But if you feel that there is pressure on you to do wrong things, because that's what the corporation does, and you have to kind of do what the corporation demands of you, then it starts to become problematic, because then they are forcing you to do immoral things. It's like being born in a mafia family. If you're born in a mafia family and the mafia says you must kill, you don't get out of jail just because they say you must kill. You are still responsible for your actions. And the same will be true in the corporate world. So ideally, you should find a corporation which is reasonably benign. You know what the most benign corporation is? The Sangha, yeah? The Sangha is the most benign corporation. So that's why we have monks and nuns. So you are really kind of, you know, you are heading. But there are a lot of variety in the world. There are corporations that are reasonably good. Yeah, there are good people in the corporate world, and there are corporations that are bad. But if the demand is that you must do a lot of really bad things, sometimes it's better to change your job. But if it's just minor things here and there, it probably doesn't matter all that much. We should never strive for absolute perfection. Or we should strive for it, but we should realize that there are sometimes limitations. Yeah, and that's okay. Just have to find that balance there somewhere. Yeah.
One thing, interesting thing came to my mind. We, like I said earlier, we're building kutis now in Bodhinyana. There's more and more monks who want to ordain. And so I'm helping there. We have a bricklayer there. And the bricky told me a couple of weeks ago, he was working hard and he was putting the bricks down. He said, "There must be more to life than this." I look at him and said, "I'm sorry, Eddie, there's not. you're just laying the bricks. You're just putting a brick down, and it's like that's it. What can you do? That's life.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing
you lay bricks and then you die. Yeah.
Then you die. Yeah. You get a little bit of money. You enjoy the fruit of the benefits of the money. A little bit, but all that. But the interesting thing, I thought it was a bit funny. So I told that to Ajahn Brahm at night time, and he said, "No, there is actually more to life than that." There is, and I was like, "Oh, that's interesting." And he said that you can actually put loving kindness to every time you're laying a brick. So there is actually more to life than that. So while you're doing that work, you're adding a good brick into your life. You're adding more wisdom. You're adding more, you know, kindness, understanding, all these things. So there is more to life than laying bricks.
So that is exactly, and then that translates also into what you are asking Ariel and Aline as well, that the idea is that when you work, you can add kindness into your work. Whether you're a bricklayer or whatever you do, you can add kindness into it. And the way to do that is to think about your co-workers, to think about your customers. Yeah, okay, I'm going to do the best I can to make my customers satisfied, to be kind to my co-workers. Oh, my dear co-worker, can I make you a cup of tea? Actually, co-worker, I forgot to tell you this, but I really appreciate your presence. Yeah, you've been working together now for X number of years. Wow, I feel so lucky to have a wonderful co-worker like you. If you say that to a co-worker, they're going to get, whoa. They've probably never heard that before, yeah? Actually, I've never told you that, when would it have?
Yes, you did.
But I really...
No, hold. I hear this all the time.
Do you? You are one of the best co-workers, actually, and so is Venerable Metaji, by the way. And the nuns are also marvelous co-workers.
That's true.
And so is everyone else at the Buddhist Society as well. You're all good, wonderful co-workers. So this is the thing. We can add that kindness into the way, into work life. So sometimes, maybe if you do a few dodgy things, but generally you can add a lot of kindness, and you can actually practice the path even at work in that way.
It even applies to paying taxes, because a lot of countries go to war with the money that you pay. So it doesn't mean that you stop paying taxes. But a lot of the money in some countries, take the United States, a lot of the money that you pay.
But remember, it is only a problem, Nalin.
They go to war.
They do.
And kill people.
But
so, this, yeah. So it's a very difficult balance.
Remember
very
the, difficult. Yeah. But remember, it's about intention. Yeah. So if you pay your taxes with the intention that may my country go to war with this money, yeah, I'm going to give you money, please go to war with this money. If that's how you think, then it's a really problem. But if you say, okay, I'm going to pay my taxes because most of it, only a small proportion goes to the defense, most goes to, actually, defense is a bit of a misnomer, goes to offense. Offense is probably more likely. But the most of it goes to schools, to roads, to healthcare, yeah? And Australia, how large is the defense budget? Maybe 3%? Yes, it's a tiny, tiny percentage. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's a misnomer, isn't it? Okay. Okay, very good. Anything else, anyone? Anyone would have done, you want to add anything?
No.
No? Okay, enough added.
Yeah, I mean...
Okay, so nice to see you all again. Thank you, everyone, for coming. And we will continue next week. If you fill up for more next week, we'd love to see you again next week. Let's just pay homage to Bodhidharma Sangha.
You said last week that we don't really know if we are practicing the path properly until we gain stream entry. Yeah? But you know, in the suttas, there's quite a few instances where the Buddha just gave one talk and everybody become a stream enterer. I mean, like, is that believable?
Yeah, not really. Those are often exaggerations. The way to know that you're practicing the right way is just to look at the long term. If you are, you know, gradually moving in the right direction, you're becoming a bit more mindful, your defilements are going down a little bit, you're becoming a bit more good-hearted. If you see that happening, you know you're practicing right. That's the right way to think about it. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's not that easy. Not just one Dharma talk.
It's not that easy. No, maybe there were a few very exceptional cases.